And finally got something resolved. That was the sound of Yesterday Man, and you're hearing now, of course, David Bowie, the man who sold the world. And on the line now, here is Dr. Gerald Chevin. How are you, Gerald?
Well, good afternoon. I've managed to beat the snow, so...
So I hear. How bad is it there?
Well, it's not terrible where I live, but in certain places, it's absolutely awful. But no, it's actually, when I look out the window now, it's quite sunny. But yeah, everything's copacetic. We're getting on quite well.
Can I tell you what it's like here?
Oh, I don't know.
It's sunny and 21 degrees.
Of course it is.
Of course it is, yeah.
I didn't expect anything less.
Well, I started off with Yesterday Man today because, obviously, let's say we're talking with Dr. Gerald Chevin. This is our second part of our sort of series of interviews with a man. It's not who he recorded, it's who he didn't record, which is fascinating. But we're talking about those he did record, and the sessions that he was involved in. And tell us a little bit about the session, the album, The Man Who Sold the World, because I know it's quite an interesting feature, isn't it?
Well, the thing about the David Bowie sessions was that during that period of time, unfortunately, he was a little bit worse for wear on the powder front. And he didn't turn up very much. We had his producer who managed to sort of salvage things, a guy called Tony Visconti, and who is quite well known. And the guitarist, unfortunately, Mick, he did a really good job. And just very occasionally, Mr. Bowie popped in to do what he had to do and then popped out again. It was really not something that he seemed to be very dedicated to, or just wasn't in the mood to do anything. Consequently, it all worked out fine in the mix, so to speak, but it wasn't an easy time for anybody involved in the sessions, especially the people that were having to pay for the studio, because nobody knew when he was going to turn up or not. But somehow or other, by hook or by crook, we managed to do it. And generally speaking, I mean, I got on very well with him. I knew him back in the day when he was called Davy Jones.
And, my gosh, that far back.
Yeah, well, you know, he's been around a long time, actually. It wasn't, you know, and as far as Tony Visconti was concerned, he wanted to sort of up his game, which he obviously did. And he really did some fantastic work. And David just sort of sang as and when he was required. And he was required a lot more than he turned up, but somehow we sorted it. But it was a great time to be working with him. But
I'd worked creative, on him,
I'd worked on other things with him, and he was a lot more with it, if that's the right phrase. He knew what was going on, but during the making of this album, it was very spasmodic and quite difficult. But you know, somebody was paying the bill, so that's all
indeed,
that really matters.
Indeed, I mean, it was a period where he did have, medication problems, and also, of course, he was very into Angie as well at the time, I suppose. So he was preoccupied and obviously distracted, I would imagine, quite a lot by that.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, he would turn up in the studio sometimes and no idea what they were going to do, and he would just kind of sit there and write something down on the sort of back of a fag packet, so to speak, and you turn out a great tune. Mick was very good. Mick Ronson was very good at transcribing his thoughts, right. David's thoughts, to music, because David couldn't read. Well, lots of people couldn't
It's the creativity, isn't it? It's what he's got in his head and how he comes out with great lyrics and great tunes.
Oh, yeah, and you can't believe what comes out of his head. It was quite amazing.
And he never... He would always sort of talk about the incredible input and performances and the creativity that came from people like Mark and Tony in creating that. I mean, as you know, my partner Laura knew David fairly well in later years, in the 78, 79, when he was far more, shall we say, controlled, and he was in control, I suppose you can say. He had Coco with him all the time, and he did the Elephant Man and he was recording, and he actually told the band that they were running, called Student Teachers, not to sign for RCA Records.
Well, there's a lot of stories about that. I'm not sure we're allowed to say any of that stuff without sort of getting our what's it soon.
No, so, it's been published. It's all right.
Oh, right. Well, then, I'm not going to be the
it's
one
been cleared. It's been cleared.
Good.
No, but it was an understanding that came about. But the thing is about his creativity, as you quite rightly say, you were there and you were sort of working with Mark Ronson and Tony Visconti. Did you work with them a lot in the years? I'd imagine you did,
well,
especially with Tony.
Everything seems to have a tenuous link, you see. Certainly, Tony Visconti used to be the assistant to a very well-known record producer that was actually Argentinian. His name was, because unfortunately he's no longer with us, Denny Cordell. I don't know if that name
Denny Cordell.
Anything to
you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
now,
I remember the name.
He started off producing the Moody Blues, and when he we did Go Now, and when he moved up to various other things, one of the bands he started off with, he dragged me down we went to Birmingham to a place called the Cedar Club. And he said, this band is just going to blow you away.
Yeah.
And you have to remember that I used to go and see lots and lots and lots of acts. So it would take a lot to impress me, to be honest.
So you went to see lots of acts. I mean, as a recording engineer, was it because you were asked to do this by the studio?
Yeah, to see if I felt that, it was
worth recording.
Yes, exactly. And so we got to the Cedar Club, which is, I don't know if it's still there, but it was a very famous club in Birmingham. And there was a massive, great queue outside. But because there were four of us, there was myself, Denny Cordell, a guy called Tony Secunda, and somebody else I can't actually remember. Mm-hmm. We just went straight in because they sort of VIP type status. And then this band came out on the stage and they proceeded to perform. And they blew me away. And 2 weeks later, they were in the studio and we did a track which did exceedingly well. It was called Night of Fear by The Move, Denny Cordell produced. And Roy Wood came across as just one of the most talented people I'd seen for a long, long time. Very recordable, very personable, and really keen and enthusiastic. Well, Denny then started to produce them regularly. We did another track with them, which I sort of, these are all like top five hits. I can't tell you what.
Indeed,
they got to. There were so many different magazines that depending on which one you read, it was whether it was number one or not. But we did another one called I Can Hear the Grass Grow.
Yeah.
And then the big one, I think, of theirs was called Flowers in the Rain.
That's right.
Which had two things going for it. One,
well, it opened Radio One.
Yeah, and it also had my sound effects starting it.
That's right.
Because I was a real nerd, and I used to go around with my little...
I used to do that, Gerald.
Standing in the rain, recording thunders and lightning. And anyway,
Did you ever find yourself when you were sort of, say, out or you're in a taxi or in a bus or you were walking or in a store and you heard something, think, God, I wish I could have recorded that?
Well, if I'd have had the technology on my phone,
I used to think, you know, as well. I mean, good gracious, now it's so easy now, but back then,
that's such a fleeting moment.
Indeed.
But, yeah. So we put that thunder and lightning at the beginning, and then they needed some sort of woodwind and stuff. So that's where Tony Visconti came in. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And if you listen to Flowers in the Rain, you'll hear.
Well, you're going to hear it in a moment because I've got it queued up.
Right. Well, then you can all listen to it and see exactly what I mean.
Okay. Well, let's have a listen to Flowers in the Rain. Of course, as you know, that Tony Blackburn, he opened up Radio 1 1969, and this was the first track he played as well.
With all my blankets in a heap and yellow roses scattered all around. The time was still approaching, for I couldn't stand it anymore. So Mary goes upon my eider down. I'm just sitting watching flowers in the rain. Feel the power of the rain making the garden grow. I'm just sitting watching flowers in the rain. Feel the power of the rain. With all the windows open wide, couldn't pressurize my head from speaking. Hoping not to make a sound, I pushed my head into the ground. It's time to catch the sight that I was seeking. I'm just sitting watching flowers in the rain. Feel the power of the rain making the garden grow. I'm just sitting watching flowers in the rain. Feel the power of the rain. In the breeze, make conversation with the trees. Believe to leave reality behind me. With my commitments in a mess, my sleep is gone away. Deep rest in a world of fantasy. You'll find me. I'm just sitting watching flowers in the rain. Feel the power of the rain making the garden grow. I'm just sitting watching flowers in the rain. Feel the power of the rain.
Flowers in the Rain, The Move, and talking with Dr. Daryl Chavin about his experiences and also, I suppose you can say, his rather wonderful life as a recording engineer in the centre of London at Advision Studios back there in the 60s. Tell us a bit about the equipment of the station, of the studio, because I'm talking about equipment.
Yeah.
You really did have, I mean, I've got two lovely pictures you sent me yesterday, and of course I have seen them before, about the studios you had. The equipment you had in the desk was looked very, very different to the one you had towards the end of the 60s. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, when I started, you know, I told you before I was just a T-boy, but I did understand quite a lot about electronic design, and everything was vacuum tube or valve. And sometimes, because we were using it an awful lot, little fires used to start in the heater wires. And you think you're going to do everyone a favor by trying to blow it out. But as you breathe in to blow it out, you're catching all this horrible smell and everything, and you're choking.
Sure.
Anyway, it didn't take too long. The boss of the studio said to me, look, could you design a mixing console that was solid state.
So they are. So you were asked as T-Boy to design the mixing console. Well, is that what you're saying?
No, they didn't have overnight. I could hardly make the tea. No. But they, you know, after about 6 to 8 months, I'd obviously graduated from tea to other things. And I sort of suggested that we do this, that, and the other, and we got a few people to help, and we built this console, and it took about 6 months. Oh, yeah, but every studio in those days had their own console.
There was no Neve.
There was no anything. Everybody built their own equipment.
Yeah.
And building it using solid state rather than, using vacuum tubes made it run a lot cooler. The biggest problem with transistorized things in those days was that when you overload sound using vacuum tube technology or valve, the harmonics all into sort of mix with each other and actually improve the sound. But if you use solid state technology, it's a rasping, horrible noise. And so that's one of the reasons why it's taken up to about 20 years ago, a company actually called Solid State Logic. who I know very, very well, cracked how to make, solid state stuff sound like vacuum tube.
Incredible.
Seems retrograde, but it's actually big advantage. But anyway, so we did that. We spent the whole weekend installing it into, because obviously we couldn't have the studio open. We installed it in, and it was, for some reason or other, somebody decided it should be blue, right? And we called this console Old Blue. Anyway, the very first day on the Monday morning, having worked 48 hours over the weekend, they said to me, well, you'd better do the first session because the only one who knows what to do with it. So I was absolutely shattered. And anyway, so all these session musicians come trundling in and we were doing something or other. And all of a sudden, it stopped working. And, you know, session musicians are quite expensive, but they were relative to what was going on in those days.
Indeed.
And, of course, there's a load of bright sparks. And they all said to me, well, if you'd have made it green instead of blue, that really helped me. Anyway, I managed to fix it. And it was fine after that. But, you know, everything that you install as new gives you teething troubles. But we got there, and it lasted for, well, until about 10 years, until we then bought an American piece of kit called Quad 8, which...
Oh, you went for a quadraphonic sound with that.
Yeah, but it was all motorized faders and memory faders and all that kind of stuff. In those days, that was the next step. But this console, I mean, even the Valve console, churned out hundreds of hit records for various people. I mean, you played earlier the Chris Andrews thing. Yep. Well, I don't know if you know anything about Chris, but
I was going to ask you because we had a little problem with connecting to you. I was going to ask you a bit about Chris. So just go back and drop that in, yes.
Well, he was born in Romford in Essex, and I actually live in Essex. I wasn't born there, but I live in. And so we had an affinity, but... he was also sort of like had German influence. That's why lots of things he did, like Yesterday Man, Pretty Belinda, if you've ever heard that.
Yeah, yes, I remember them all. I met him once back in the 70s,
you know, yeah, it's all a bit oompa-pa. And that's, you know, but of course he wrote tons of stuff that didn't sound like that for Sandy Shore, et cetera.
So
probably still is a very talented man. And the biggest hit he ever had was completely, you know, out of left field, I think, as far as he was concerned. Yesterday Man was a massive great hit. And, of course, in places like Germany, where he overdubbed the track and sang it in German because he could speak German fluently. He was a one-off. Going back to, Tony Visconti, Tony began to appreciate the studio had vision and what we could and couldn't do. And he then brought his next discovery, if you like, into the studio, a guy called Mark Bolan.
Oh, right. Heard of him.
That's not his real name, of course.
I know.
So Mark started off with that there were just two of them. He was playing the guitar and a guy called Steve was doing the sort of like bongo type things. And we did a track which was, well, I didn't like it, but I didn't have any choice in what happened. Mm. But it was called Deborah.
And yes, that's right.
That, surprising enough, was an incredible hit. And then we did a lot of other stuff with Mark. And I'd met Mark before because he was in another group. Everything's tenuous. He was in another group before that called John's Children.
That's right.
Very
yeah.
few people have ever heard of.
Well, I actually had a copy. I had Deborah. I thought it was Deborah or Desdemona on with John's Children being the performers, and it was just like Deborah. And you say it was actually came out as Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Yes, that's right.
So maybe I should have kept that single. It might be quite worth a few, Bob.
Yeah, the people at the record label found it very difficult to spell it.
That's true. That makes sense. Yeah, John's Children works, but T-Rex is even easier.
Yeah. And the group John's Children were produced by a guy called Simon Napier Bell.
Simon Napier Bell, sure.
All the Wham stuff, etc., etc. But Tony took over and was very, very successful with him. Denny went on to work with another bunch of people. And we did probably we didn't just do this at Advision, we did it in three different studios.
Trident was one of the studio that did a lot of work with you, wasn't it?
Yeah, this was Olympic, which was in Barnes. Right. I mean, all these places have gone now, but and
they'll bring back memories to me, you know, as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, I used to sort of travel all the way there, but we did this track, and I think as far as my career was concerned, it's probably the biggest selling, the most popular track ever. It was Whiter Shade of Pale with Procol Harum, produced by Denny Cordell. And, you know, we spent so long over it, in the end, you really couldn't even hear it anymore. It was just, you know, if you spend weeks and weeks listening to the same thing all the
time, you
completely lose the viability of what you're listening
well,
to.
Well, we briefly touched on Whiter Shade of Pale last week, and I asked you, did you have a title for your book? And you've actually told me it's The Whiter Shade of Sound. Is that right?
Well, that's right. I just thought it was clever, but maybe not. I don't know.
Well, it works because, I mean, it was one of the massive hits that you were involved with very closely. It was a huge, huge successful hit for Procol Harum. And even though there was a little bit of controversy about it, but it
well, yeah. I mean, I ended up designing a recording studio for a guy called Matthew Fisher, who played the keyboards on Whiter. He lived in Kingston on Thames. He now lives in Connecticut, and then the other half of the year he lives around Kingston on Thames.
Okay.
And so I built a studio for him, and we did some Robin Trower stuff. I don't know if you've heard of Robin Trower.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we did that kind of stuff. So everything, you know, say somehow or other, everything's got this tenuous link running through it, even down to the fact, which, go on.
That's understandable in a way, because you certainly didn't just sort of sit in a studio and twiddle knobs. You were very active around the whole process at that time, and that is that's a heck of a legacy, Gerald.
Well, I was going to say the weirdest thing. I mean, I've had to record stuff that was completely above and beyond my control. I think 6 weeks before the move came in to do Flowers in the Rain, we had Tony Blackburn come in to sing.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's just memorable because it's just memorable. I won't say anymore.
I won't say anymore, yeah.
No.
Don't alert the lawyers.
Yeah.
So, he's a lovely guy. I met him. He came down here many years ago.
He was a charming guy.
And I worked with him for a while, actually, on this station about 10 years ago now. And it was sweet. It was lovely to meet him. And, I mean, he's still going. He's still on air.
Oh, very much so. Very much so. But he tried his hand.
He tried to sing.
or tried his throat at singing or whatever. But, you know, anyway, that's by the by. But, yeah, so everything somehow, when I look into all the various things I've done, you can almost link things together somehow because something ricochets off of something else, et cetera, et cetera. It was because of Denny Cordell that I went to Woodstock.
Right.
I was one of the many engineers at Woodstock, probably the youngest one. But we did, you know, Joe Cocker and The Who, because all the English acts wanted to have a sort of English guy in charge of their sound.
Did you ever get yourself in the Woodstock movie, running around the stage, sort of plugging stuff in?
Well, my main concern at Woodstock was it never stopped raining.
Yeah, I know.
It was pouring. And so my main concern was that people didn't get electrocuted because of, you know, electricity and rain don't actually mix very well.
Indeed.
And so concern number one was that I didn't get electrocuted, and then I worried about everybody else afterwards. And it was so wet that I guess even now, occasionally, when I have a shower, some mud still comes out my beard.
I love it. You had a wonderful,
amazing time.
You had a wonderful. It must have been. You were immersed. You were immersed, I would imagine, in the whole process. That it was just your life.
Well, music is still, a major part of my life.
Okay,
but
we're going to have to cut it short, unfortunately, Gerald, today.
Oh,
because
right.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to go to an ad break. I'm just going to say to people out there. The way, in fact, I got to know Dr. Gerald Chavin was actually through the pandemic. Do you remember?
Yeah.
A friend of my partner's in Texas decided to set up this Zoom meeting where he'd bring musicians and photographers and artists together on the Zoom meeting each Saturday afternoon there, and we would sort of either create an artist or play an album and discuss it and play it, and Gerald once joined it from the UK, and I sort of got to know him through that Zoom meeting back in 2020 when I was still living in New York, and that's how we got to know each other, isn't it, Gerald?
Absolutely. We've never actually physically met him.
No, first. No. The wonders of technology.
Maybe that's a good thing. I don't know.
Gerald, it's been great talking to you again. Now, I wanted to discuss you. I want to spend time next week. We're talking about your involvement in the Richard Branson sort of studio project. And, of course, then we're going to discuss Tubular Bells.
Sure, absolutely. Look forward to it. Have a lovely weekend, everybody.
And you, and we'll make sure everything works properly next week.
I'll
make sure
okay.
The technology's right. I'm gonna play out now with our ad break, and we'll have a little piece of. I think we'll just have a bit of the move to take us out of this hour here on the Friday Conversation. Take care, Joe. Talk to you soon. Take care.
Thank you very much. Bye bye.